All right, let's jump into it this week. We've got, I think Apple is committed to a major goal in 2030, by 2030. We have some fun new beta updates. And one of the coolest things, in my opinion, is this iPhone 12 story that we'll talk about a little bit later on. But first off, tell me about Apple's carbon neutral 2020 goal so I understand what's happening here.
Sure. So I think they announced at the end of 2019 that they were now fully carbon neutral in their operations. And that means like their buildings, so obviously Apple Park and Infinite Loop, and then, you know, all their offices they have in London and all these other countries, right? They have the LA office, which does Apple TV stuff. And the idea of them is that they were carbon neutral, which means that all the carbon that they generate has been either it's been made directly by green energy sources, like in the case of Apple Park, they power it based off the solar panels that are on the roof, or in some cases, especially like retail stores,
it's offset, right?
So they either fund like a development program for, you know, building trees in a faraway place, or they pay someone, you know, because there's most companies when they approach environmental issues like this is that there are plenty of like, you know, middlemen companies around the globe that you can just pay money to. They say, look, if you need to offset this amount of carbon, you pay some money and we'll go off and offset it for you, right? Apple is trying to be more proactive than that, and you'd hope they would be, seeing as they're, you know, the biggest company in the world with the most resources. Like, they hired Lisa Jackson, who you know, obviously has like a huge background in green energy and stuff, to help lead this initiative. So like, when most companies say they're going carbon neutral, it just means they're like just paying someone else to do it for them, if you know what I mean. Like, and technically, they're carbon neutral, but it's not quite the same level of achievement as doing it properly. And I think, you know, in what they announced today, they said that they want to make their entire business carbon neutral, which extends to the supply chain. And that includes all of the partners that, you know, their manufacturing partners, the people they contract out to make parts and components for the final product. And they said they've already got like 80% of suppliers on board to take their stuff carbon neutral, and presumably they'll round out the rest by, you know, by this 2030 deadline. And I think there was somewhere in the roadmap it said something like 80% of their company's carbon output will be from green energy sources, and then that 20% stuff is like the offsetting, you know, thing, because they have the solar panels on Apple Park, they have the big solar panel arrays next to all their data centers, right? And then they're, you know, doing a load more projects in that domain. And you know, they like to shout about these things because they're impressive, but they, you know, it's meaningful, and they wouldn't have to do this stuff, right? Like, they could easily be the biggest company in the world and not care about environmental issues, but I think it's, you know, it's nice to see them do it.
Yeah, it's a cool thing. You know, and just breaking down what it means to be carbon neutral like you did is helpful, because I think if you look at it, you know, buying credits is a thing that is pretty scalable. I think what Apple's doing is better than that, but also harder to scale, because how much of buying forests is, you know, doing the forestry stuff is possible for every company. So long term, having this 10-year-old goal is really nice. I like that.
Yeah, and it also extends to product design, right? That means stuff like shrinking the amount of packaging you're using,
yes,
changing the materials in the phones themselves and the devices, like and making more stuff about recyclable materials. One of the announcements in this press release was that the 16-inch MacBook Pro is now going to be, the chassis of the 16-inch MacBook Pro is going to be made using a process that minimizes carbon emissions. So normally when you like smelt, I didn't know this, I was just reading the press release, right? But normally when you smelt aluminium, it produces like a load of carbon dioxide. Well, they've worked with some teams and, you know, done a lot of research, and now they've got a process that can basically produce oxygen instead of carbon dioxide. So that material is now being used in the 16-inch MacBook Pro. So that's one way where they can, you know, they're not needing to like offset, they're just literally reducing their overall emissions, right? So, and that extends to stuff like their, you know, trade-in programs, and they spoke about before, like Daisy and the robots that dismantle the products. They said they've got a new one this year called Dave, and that's specifically for the Taptic engine. So they're able to recover the earth magnets that are inside the Taptic engine and reuse them for, you know, future phones and stuff, which is cool. So it's all kind of like weaving into that goal. I think in it was last year or the year before, Lisa Jackson actually said that Apple wants to go to a closed loop ecosystem, mm-hmm, where that would literally mean they're making new products out of old products and not requiring new raw materials. That commitment isn't part of this thing, because I think she kind of overplayed it when they said it before, like it was a long-term goal, but they don't actually know how they're going to get there yet. So, but
right, yeah, I
agree. But they're on the path, and obviously that's a huge task, and it's not included notably in this commitment to go carbon neutral by 2030, so presumably it's going to be further out than that. But anytime they can, you know, reuse the Taptic engines, or with the Mac Minis and the MacBook Air, they already like melt down aluminium from older products and reuse them to make the aluminium that goes into your devices, right? So like anything on that basis helps them get towards that closed loop goal, but that's not something that's going to be achieved anytime soon. We'll obviously track progress as the, you know, as the decade goes on, but obviously, you know, Apple's, if they say they're going to do this, they're going to do this. Like, yeah, you know, they don't go back on their word on this kind of stuff.
Yeah, the closed loop talk is from April 19th, 2017, so Earth Day 2017, and what she said is, it sounds crazy, but we're working on it, talking about going closed loop. Says, one day we'd like to be able to build new products, or she says, we're moving toward a closed loop supply chain. One day we'd like to build products, new products, with just recycled materials, including old products. So so we're getting there. You know, of course, it's important to remember that you can't like celebrate the goals and promises, that you've got to wait for the achievements to come through. But one thing about Apple is, and as long as I've followed Apple, they're good for keeping discussion about environmental efforts, you know, front and center. Even when it comes to producing new products, you know, they always make it part of the keynote. Well, they, I don't think they recently, but they used to do it as part of the keynote, where they're like, you know, here's you know, the breakdown of like,
yeah,
the environmental impact.
Yeah,
exactly. Like, yeah. So cool. Anything else on carbon neutral by 2030?
Yeah. One of the funny things, if you go on their like the apple.com website, they have this like page where they're laying this all out. And one of their like kind of marketing ways of doing it is lighter right out of the box, lighter on the environment.
Oh yeah. Yes.
And that's just like, and it shows an iPhone box. Right. And obviously this is going to be one of their angles for the change that happens with the iPhone 12, where they stop including the earphones and the power adapter. They can very strongly make the green argument there that this is just wasteful, right? Like, and you can quite literally make a lighter box by including less stuff in that box.
Yeah,
it's quite funny. Yeah,
yeah. It all connects back together. All right, let's talk about the next thing, which is the Security Research Device Program. This week, Apple, I guess, kind of fulfilled a promise that they made before, and they're delivering these iPhones that are just made to be hacked. And this is all part of the overall picture of Apple slowly, kind of reactionarily, or as a reaction to criticism, changing how they operate with sort of the well intent of like bug hunters.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously a market for bad intent bug hunters, but in this case, Apple's, you know, infrastructure internally has been, if you're a bug hunter, it's all bad for the most part. There's no incentive to do the right thing in this case. Even if you do, it won't be responsive. In this case, they've got an official program, official devices that are part of this. So tell me more about this program.
Yeah, like you kind of hit the nail on the head there. This is like the next step in kind of a multi-year process to be more like friendly and amenable to like the Security Research Committee. You go back 3 years and Apple was like the only tech company that didn't have like a bug bounty program. They were very they would accept, you know, security bug reports, but it kind of felt distanced, and there wasn't good relationships between, you know, the third party research community, which composes a lot of just like enthusiast people, you know, like you and me, that are just, you know, doing hacking for fun, and they find some, you know, very serious bugs that affect, you know, the millions and millions of devices that get used every single day. And, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, institutionally, Apple just kind of didn't really care. Or they, you know, they would do the minimum necessary to like take the bug report in and then, you know, eventually fix it. And this obviously flared up into the public eye with that group FaceTime bug report, right, where, you know, this random kid discovered it and then it got submitted, but it turned out it was ignored for 3 weeks, and then someone else found out about it, and, you know, that whole rigmarole just kind of like, I think it made them, okay, we're actually gonna, you know, do this seriously now, and not just like, if we've got serious bug reports coming in, they can't just sit in like a pile of emails for 3 months before we actually notice it, right? And we had a similar issue with the with the HomeKit bug, that must have been, what, 2017 when, our friend Chaos Tian, he found a, rather crazy compromised issue with HomeKit where he could basically hack into anyone's home, and he demonstrated to you by like opening your lock, right, in your your house.
Yeah, turn the light on.
Yeah, turn the light on. Like, yeah, that's crazy.
In that case specifically, all he needed was the Apple ID used for your HomeKit, and it was like a vulnerability in how remote access was handled. And so the fix for that was for Apple to turn off remote access for HomeKit until they release an update that fixed the flaw. But like the treatment in that case was like, once they knew about it, they didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want us to talk about it. They just wanted it to exist for like weeks before they could fix it, and not release like the hot fix, which is turning off remote access to HomeKit.
Yeah, without the pressure from like us of posting it, it could have been just left for months, right? Like,
yeah.
And I don't think that would happen today. They're much more aggressive in following up and reporting. That's very important. And they now, compensate people for their time because they have the full bug bounty program instated. It pays pretty well. Last year in the 2019, conference at Black Hat, they doubled most of the payouts. They've added new higher payouts. And one of the announcements in that presentation was this security research device program,
right.
Which basically means that like the iPhone hardware is very locked down in many, many ways. And that can actually make it hard for security researchers to actually do their job, right? Because they might find a potential vulnerability, but they haven't, it's like a jigsaw puzzle, right? They might have like a few of the corners, but they can't put the whole thing together without testing it. And the security framework and infrastructure and the limitation on arbitrary codes execution and having no access to like a shell, which is like a command line, right? That's the standard issue with all customer phones and all customer iPads. But if you're trying to actually find bugs, it's helpful to be able to have access to those weaker restrictions while you're actually finding the bug, and then making sure it still works when you finally get down to a shipping device. You know what I mean, right? So before now, obviously Apple's internal security teams had access to the devices, but externally there was basically no way to get them. Some devices would kind of leak out and get sold on the black market for lots of money, and some, security researchers definitely have bought those devices essentially illegally just to make sure they can find these exploits. But now finally, Apple has an official program for this where you can, if you are a known security researcher who submitted bug reports in the past, you can apply to get some of this hardware. Obviously, Apple is not just going to give it out to anyone on the street because they don't want it to be spread that widely, which is perfectly reasonable. But as long as you have a history of submitting bugs to Apple, that are serious enough that having access to this kind of hardware would be important, they say that you'll be eligible. They do say there's only a limited quantity this year, so depending on the number of people that apply, you might not actually all get. They might not all get in, but that those applications will roll over to next year. Who knows how many they're going to have? Like 200, 300. Who knows? But it's important that this actually does exist because they promised it, and then. There was a rumor actually, like late last year, that Apple had given up on this. Someone just on Twitter, the Twitter security researcher, just complaining that Apple had, dumped the idea. And I think we asked them, and they said, "Oh, we're still working on it." And now finally, they've delivered it, right? But it's just a good step, and hopefully, giving access to this stuff, giving access to this hardware, will eventually result in bugs being found that wouldn't have been found otherwise.
Sure.
And then,
yeah.
Part of the commitment of getting this hardware is that you must report the vulnerability directly to Apple, because they don't want people getting these devices, finding a bug, and then just going selling it to Grayshift or one of those companies that then sell on to very nefarious groups or the police or that kind of stuff, right? So part of the commitment of getting this hardware is that if you do find a bug, you must report it directly to Apple promptly, and then they'll qualify you for the eligible bug bounties or whatever after they've done their verification. But fingers crossed, major security vulnerabilities will be found more easily now and be able to feed back into the security of everyone's devices. I did see one complaint from Will Strafaka. He's a developer / security hacker.
He's at Chronic is who he is.
Yeah, at Chronic on Twitter, exactly. Yeah. He has, runs a Guardian VPN firewall app for iOS and plenty of other things. He had a long history in the jailbreak community. He said that his team aren't going to get these devices, or they're not going to even reply because the terms on what you're allowed to share publicly are too limiting, which is a, you know, potential issue because I don't know the details there, but if it does put too many straitjackets on the researchers involved, they might just opt out and not join the program because they want to talk about this stuff with other people and share ideas and stuff. So if it is too prohibitive there, hopefully Apple will, you know, ease the policies a bit. But obviously having the program at all has to be better than not having it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask you about some of the restrictions and requirements. First one is, do you need glasses for this? Because, oh my gosh, this, the image that they use on their website to apply is like, you know, code running on the iPhone. Is this just like for show? I'm super serious.
You can definitely get a screen like that on an iPhone. If you jailbreak your phone and you turn on like verbose mode, the boot sequence is like that.
Okay.
Because if you on the Mac, you know, when you boot on the Mac, I can't remember the exact hold. There's like a key combination you can hold down when you restart, and it will boot into verbose mode, which basically gives you like the terminal shell of everything that's happening when you start. And it looks like that on a Mac screen, so obviously it's a Mac display, but that got ported over through to iPhone OS and now iOS. So yeah, you can 100% get a screen that looks exactly like that come to the thing. I'm sure when, if you're doing like serious development, you can like plug the phone into a computer and have that same shell reproduced on another screen. Do you see what I mean? Like you can like copied over.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, like that literally will show up at that size, because I've seen it happen before.
Yeah. Okay. So good to know. I did not know if that was just for show, because it looks cool, like in some futuristic way.
Yeah, because it kind of like, it's like the classic Hollywood movie, isn't it? It's like they always show the command line and the terminal with just, you know, text flying by on a black background because it looks all clever. But right. Yeah, that you can definitely get a screen like that show up on an unlocked iPhone.
Okay. And you mentioned some of the restrictions. Some of the country stuff. So I saw another person in the same sphere as Chronic is like, you know, I live in Singapore for half of the year and I can't take this thing out of the country, so I'm not interested.
Yeah.
It seems like, and I certainly hope that from Apple's perspective, they have a list of candidates who they think this is going to be useful for.
Mm-hmm.
And they've consulted with them on what are the restrictions, because from what I can tell from just the Twitter observations are, there are people who I would know identify as like the reliable people to go to for this stuff. And for, you know, like with Chronic, you just kind of, well, this really wasn't made for them, I guess, based on the restrictions. So.
Yeah, you'd hope they would have consulted with some of the prominent groups that, you know, what policy can we implement that doesn't give you free reign to just sell the phone on eBay, but, you know, actually is useful to you. Because one of the biggest contributors of security vulnerabilities, of major security vulnerabilities in iOS, is the Google Project Zero teams. They're the ones that find, like, the zero-day exploits in iMessage and stuff. And so I'm sure they would love to have access to, you know, unlocked hardware, because the removal of arbitrary code execution restrictions means that you can like develop a tool that you can run on the phone to perform debugging, to perform testing, and that just really helps you speed up your process of actually working out, is there a real vulnerability here that I could exploit on a normal device? You do your testing, you do your debugging, and then you go and try it on a real device and see if it works when, you know, those restrictions are reimposed. So it's definitely helpful if you can get your hands on it, and I can only hope that the policy is free enough that it's actually going to be useful to people. And if it isn't, I think we've seen Apple, adjust themselves and adapt. Like, for the longest time, there wasn't even, like, a macOS bug bounty program. And then last year, they finally, you know, formalized a bug bounty program for all the operating systems. But even when people complain about it, they kind of put like back doors or side doors into the system where it's like, you know, we like you, we know you're, you know, we know you're legit, so if you do this, we'll still give you some money, even though this wasn't an official program. And so maybe that will happen here. Like, they've come out with, you know, in classic Apple fashion, rules where you have to like staple it down to a table before we have to have it.
Right.
But they might, you know, respond to the market, let's say.
Yeah, sure. So and it seems based on the fact that they do have a limited number of these devices, and they'll have a second round next year, or I guess just the next round in 2021 for applicants, that would be the point where if there needs to be changes to the program based on who can and cannot participate, that's when we probably see those changes.
Yeah, like I do think since they clearly redoubled efforts to be more amenable to the security community, I think we've seen them be pretty flexible in adapting when people have said, you know, this is just stupid, for instance. Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right, let's take a break and talk about LinkedIn.
For sure. Small businesses have unique needs. And despite the current economic uncertainty, one thing stays the same. The need and importance to have the right people on your team. When your business is ready to make its next hire, LinkedIn Jobs can help you by matching your role with qualified candidates so that you can find the right person quickly. LinkedIn is an active community of professionals with more than 690 million members worldwide. Simply start by posting the job title, company name, and location on the LinkedIn Jobs dashboard. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates with the hard and soft skills that you're looking for. It puts your job post in front of qualified members, and it's targeted to show up for just the people that are looking for a job just like yours. LinkedIn Jobs can help you hire the right person faster. LinkedIn Jobs finds people that are not only qualified, but fit in with your company's culture. It does the legwork so you can focus on hiring the person who will transform your business. When your business is ready to make that next hire, find the right person with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first $50 off. Visit linkedin.com/happyhour. Again, that's linkedin.com/happyhour to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. Our thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring the show.
Yeah, absolutely. LinkedIn has been sponsoring for a long time, and I always appreciate and look forward to it. All right, now for the super fun stuff for this week in terms of what the news is. iOS 14 Beta 3 is available. I'm running that on the iPhone. macOS 11 Big Sur Beta 3 is available. I'm running that on the MacBook Pro. And, you know, I guess they kind of came a day after we might have expected them, so there's a little bit of like a wait for them. Mm-hmm. In my experience, Beta 1 was like really awesome. Beta 2, there were changes that were rockier than the first beta just in terms of stability. Beta 3, so far so good. Like, I had a really bad problem on macOS Beta 2 where connecting to a display or disconnecting would eventually kernel panic your Mac, but not immediately. So you had like some window of time to work before the fans go like full blast and then your computer turns off.
Shut down.
Yeah.
I do think in general, people have said that iOS 14 is pretty stable, but Catalina is still pretty buggy. Or not Catalina, Big Sur is still pretty buggy.
Yeah, I think Big Sur always kind of, or I think macOS always kind of gets that comparison to iOS in terms of stability. And maybe it's just like the nature of what you do on your Mac compared to your phone. And that's kind of my hunch. Is that you know, you just do much more, and you can do different types of stuff and much more on your Mac. And so
yeah. And also this year, the like visual redesign for macOS is pretty significant. So, you know, there's scope for there to just be more bugginess in the system, right? Because they've had to rechange a lot of things, including a lot of icons.
Yeah. And in terms of what's new, one thing I was looking forward to was the clock widget that they showed off as part of iOS 14 on the iPhone and iPad at WWDC. And that is here in iOS 14 Beta 3. Did you notice any changes to the clock icon since the previous beta? Because Beta 2 added like the Apple Watch clock hands to the clock icon.
I think
icon.
It's the same. I've just got used to it.
Yeah, but I don't think that does it really match the clock widget though? Like, I mean maybe it's the weight of it. I feel like there's like a white outline around, or maybe there's not. Maybe it's just the, I don't know. But I kind of feel like it's not quite the same. But
I think it's probably just like the size of the indices of the numbers can be different on the widget than it is on the icon, right?
Okay.
Because
yeah.
The icon's so small, the numbers have to be really small. Whereas on the widget, the numbers could be bigger and they're probably bigger relative to the size of the circle. So it just feels a bit more proportioned. And so like on the icon, the thicker, you know, hands, clock hands, they kind of cover up the numbers more. Whereas on the widget, you don't get that problem as much.
Right, and you can kind of see it when you look at like the full size widget as like a single clock or multiple clocks, and or like four on a 1x1 grid. So that's cool. I like that consistency with the branding of, like, you know, we make the Apple Watch, which has analog faces. Here's an analog face world clock. I just didn't think about it, but of course the clock widget is like the widget for a world clock and not like, you know, just here's the time. So I had to display it in Central Time, living in Biloxi, that I had to use Chicago as like the nearest point of reference for Central Time. And so my widget has CHI on it, and, you know, it's probably going too far to let you customize that like a watch face.
You can do the monogram customization.
Right. Yeah. But that's one of the changes there that I was really happy about. I guess one of the big things is the music app icon, which mostly goes back to what, iOS 7?
Yeah. Or so?
Minus the total gradient, but it's the same color theme. But you know, to our delight, it's not a colored symbol on a white background. Mm-hmm. It's quite the inverse. It's sort of a white symbol on a colored background.
Yeah. So the history here is obviously from, you know, originally the music app was the iPod app, but that was, you know, way back in the day. But it was always kind of like orangey, reddy hues, right? Whether you're talking about iOS 5, iOS 6, iOS 2, iOS 7, it's always kind of been the orange and red theme. When they went to iOS 7, it was like, and, you know, just like all the stock icons in original iOS 7 land, it was a very harsh red to like light red gradient, almost like orange at the extremes. Like, they went for very pungent colors initially. And then they slowly toned that back a little bit. So it was kind of, you know, just lighter red into darker red. And then iOS 8.4 came around, which introduced Apple Music, and they ditched the red thing entirely for the rainbow effect on the white background. And so we've had that icon, you know, for four generations now, 5 years, 5 years approximately.
Yeah. There are a couple of Apple Music app icons that are currently in use. One is, I think it's like Apple Music for Musicians or something. Like, it's like the UR on the publishing side. And then one's Apple Music for Business. And they're both sort of, you know, variants of what we've seen before, but neither of them, I believe, are white backgrounds. I think the business one is like a black background with the gradient music note. Mm-hmm. And then the artist version is the gradient is the background with a white music note.
Right.
That one's my favorite.
Yeah, that one's quite nice. Yeah. I quite like this current one too. Like,
it feels good on the phone, like when you're using it, for sure.
Yeah. And obviously they'd kind of embrace the rainbow effect, but whenever you just do like four different colors in a gradient, you kind of lose the punchiness. Whereas if you can just say like the music app's red, do you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
and it's not just a flat red. There is a gradient to it. It's just subtle. But it has this kind of like branding style that you can't really convey when you're always having, you know, four different colors mixed together. Like, now they can do kind of like how they have the red for the cellular Apple Watch. They can have like the Apple Music name, just color it in red, and it'll, you know, have a lot of brand identity. And yeah, so they can follow that through now with the icon changing. And yes, it's not, you know, the prettiest icon that's ever graced this planet, right? But
it's all relative.
It's fine. And it's, to me, any change away from a white background icon is 100% a win. Like,
sure,
even if it was an ugly icon, I'd still probably prefer it, just because it's gone away from the white background. This one's like non-offensive. It's perfectly fine. And they have a nice complimentary one on Big Sur as well. It's basically the same icon, but they put some shadowing to make it look a bit, because they, you know, the Mac icons have a bit more depth to them. So they basically shadow the glyph of the music note to make it look, you know, engraved into it, essentially.
Yeah.
Which is nice. And I think very welcome. The tvOS new beta just came out as well, so I presume it's also changed on there. Because on Apple TV, the white background icons are even more annoying, because they kind of ruin the point of the parallax effect, right? So, like, the original Apple Music icon on the Apple TV was different. It was like the rainbow colors. And then,
it was beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, it was really pretty, actually. And then, like, a year into it, they changed it to a white version. It was, like, great. Because when you have a plain, flat background color, the kind of parallax depth just gets completely lost. It just looks like you're moving in 2D. So, especially on Apple TV, having the, you know, the vibrant gradient helps a lot, because you actually do get the proper parallax effect, and it doesn't just look stupid.
Yeah. I have a little bit of an idea about, like, why did the icon change for iOS 14? You know, A, it's because there's a lot of redesign within the music app, and Apple tends to change the icon if there's like a big enough change in the app itself, you know, especially if it's a service.
So yeah, and especially on the iPad, there are pretty big changes to Apple Music this year.
That's right. Yeah. And then the next thing is that the widget used to be, it would kind of match the icon. So the icon was white with the music note. The widget was white if you're in light mode or black if you're in dark mode. And then podcasts would just be purple, and it was always purple, which works kind of in both modes. By having it not be a white background, by having this sort of like, you know, red tint color to it, mm-hmm. It doesn't need to change. And so it's less drawing to change. It kind of, if you put it right next to the podcast app icon, it's just two colors you can recognize, and like those colors are those services, those, you know, types of audio. So those are the two things that I think. And then, you know, people do want icons. Like, it's been like a feature request for a long time to have, if you have a white icon, change it to black if you're in dark mode. Mm-hmm. And that's tricky. You'd have to design the dark mode version because it could really interfere with, like, if it's like a black, you know, logo on a white icon, then it's just going to be a black logo, in dark mode. But I think just in general, like, we've long opposed these like kind of sort of lazy white icons. And if you can make them a color, they don't have to be black, because that's also kind of lazy too. But if you can do a color, or, you know, make the art of the icon, the entire icon in some way, then you solve that night mode or, you know, light mode, dark mode problem. And that's what this does too.
Yeah, it works well on both themes, because mm-hmm. A lot of apps do offer icon customization. So they offer like a dark mode version and a light mode version. You just choose in the app what you want to use. Obviously, it doesn't respond damage to the theme, but I don't see Apple jumping on that bandwagon because you'd have to have like per app settings, because people would be like, I only like the light icon for this app, and I don't want the dark icon when I go dark. I want to keep the normal one, or, you know, I want all my icons to be the dark icon even when I'm in light mode. So like, that's just like a step too far for what Apple's going to add.
For Apple, sure.
Yeah. And definitely if you can adopt like this brand theme, like the gradients, like you see a podcast and music, mm-hmm. You get continuity with the widgets. Apple seems to be, you know, heavily embracing color and you know, vividness with these widgets. They want like them to pop out, and if you just had every single platter being white with some text on it, it
makes your home screen look worse.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you have the dynamic colors, it definitely helps. And if the widgets mean that Apple's gonna, you know, migrate away from a flood of white icons, I am all for it. Like, I don't need every single icon to not have a white background, but it was just getting to the point where there's so many of them, it was, you know, kind of unreal. You definitely see it on the Apple Watch. Like, the honeycomb grid is so annoying. Like, I like the honeycomb grid, but when half the icons are just like white with an icon in the middle, it becomes a lot harder to distinguish which one.
Well,
which.
Because, like, really what happens there is that it's you know, on Android, the icon is any shape, and so you're putting the any shape icon within a restraint, and it really makes the total icon size, which on the watch is meant to be like super visual and tappable. You're making the actual icon size, you know, a percentage, like, you know, 20% smaller than what it needs to be. So it's even functionally, it's not good. So
yeah. Like, if you're going to have the same shape for every icon, you need to have variety in the actual designs of the icons. They just can't all be white backgrounds. Like, calendar can be white, Safari can have the white, but you can't have like music, news, all of them. Like, it just becomes too much, and it just starts looking, A, it looks lazy, and B, it starts having usability problems because you find it hard to distinguish between them.
Yeah. Last thing I'll say, well, just a couple things. One is that I had to live with the other icon where it's white background, you know, gradient music icon. And I always found some balance there with putting music between, I think, podcasts and Twitter. And there's like some blue on one side and some Twitter on the other. Or blue and purple, you know, on either side. And it would just kind of like blend. But that was like the least I could do with that. And now I can have it in any color arrangement and feel balanced. So it's a very like particular thing. But you know, it's a win to not have the white icons. It's so, so good. And then the last thing on this is thanks to everyone who tweeted both of us about this, because anytime somebody tweets both of us together, we know it's about the show. And in this case, there were a number of tweets about like celebrating the white icon being gone. So we love that you get it, because it means a lot to us. So, next up in the new version, I know there's some new mask styles That's part of the, I guess, part of the beta process going on. People had a pretty nasty bug with storage that's been resolved since the first two betas. And then I noticed the widget page on the first screen, on like home screen zero, it's been designed to look more like not just Hacked On, but like this is part of the overall widget system.
Yeah, they keep tweaking how the old legacy widgets look on that page because, you know, you have the new modern widgets that can be small, they can be fully wide, or they can be, you know, 4x4, and they can be placed amongst the icons, but they're still, at least for this year, letting you have your old widgets, probably for compatibility reasons, obviously, so you don't just update your phone and all your widgets vanish. Of the old style, so those and those ones can't be, you know, resized or anything, but and they can't be moved off of that screen, but they just sit at the bottom. And in the first like betas, they were like stuck at the bottom, but it was kind of hard for like a, you know, regular user to really know the difference. And so in beta 3, now when you go into edit mode, there's a very very clear like border around it with like
it's like the old widgets are then one big new widget.
That background only shows up when you're editing. If you're if you're just looking at them, it's not there. But as soon as you go to jiggle mode, the background comes in. So it's very clear, like, here's this section of all your old stuff, and you can customize it in there. But really, you've got to use the, you know, the new shiny stuff that sits above it.
Yeah, yeah. I like what they're doing. It's getting polished up, as you would expect, and the new update. The other thing is really, with iOS 14 relates to watchOS 7, which is at WWDC, whenever they announce automatic hand washing detection, and like I said, do like air quotes on automatic and detection, but they have the hand washing feature where, you know, it will try to determine that you're washing your hands and run a timer for 20 seconds to make sure that you don't stop before it's totally effective. And they mentioned that I think it'd be like location based as well, so that when you leave home or arrive at work, that this would be a time to be notified, not just when you're washing your hands, but also, hey, you should wash your hands now that you've changed locations. And that's built into watchOS 7 and iOS 14 betas 3. And it's an optional thing too, right? Like, you don't have to opt into it, you don't have to live with it. You can turn it off if you don't want it.
Yeah, you can have just the automatic reminders when it notices the hand motion, or you can have the location ones where if you come home and you don't wash your hands, it's like, you should wash your hands now. So you can have either or none at all, yeah.
Yeah, but it requires an Apple Watch, right? Like, even, because I was thinking about this, and even if you just had an iPhone, there are so many features from the watch that also just work with the iPhone on its own. I don't think hand washing is one of them, but you could have that location-based reminder. I mean, you could string one together on your own too. And I guess the reason it's not on the iPhone only is because it also kind of, it wants you to do the 20 seconds thing.
Well, yeah, because the idea is that it won't notify you the moment you walk through the door. It'll give you a
It's only if you haven't.
Yeah, exactly. So the iPhone can't know if you've washed your hands or not, whereas the watch can do it. And then if you haven't done it, it will remind you to do it.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Anything else from iOS 14 beta 3 that stuck out to you this week?
I mean, there was some minor, like, you know, it's the classic beta 3 where they, you know, shove some little things around, they fix some bugs. But the big stuff was like the icon stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the big stuff is the music icon. It's so cool.
Yeah.
it's actually, I like it so much that I put together, you know, I was doing for iOS 14 one home screen with, you know, some changing widgets and then like a total of 8 icons, but in different arrangements, you know, 4 over here and a grid, 4 over here across. And then the dock, and then there was like home screen zero for the old school widgets for now. And then I'd swipe over and it was just the app library, which I still really enjoy. But now I'm doing a second home screen for the biggest music widget and then the like 2x4 podcast widget. And I know why I rejected that before, because it was either all white in light mode, which I use during the day for legibility, or, you know, then it kind of looked cool at night when it was black. But now that it's a color, it looks as good as the like podcast widget. I mean, for all the reasons we just discussed. So I've got a new home screen in the mix just because Apple changed the icon and affected the widget. So, yeah. Cool. All right, let's talk about macOS Big Sur Beta 3.
OS with controversial icon decisions.
that's true. This came out later in the day, which is weird but typical for macOS. Happens all the time. It took forever to get this to install for me. a bunch of times I had like the message that it's like it couldn't install on this version of macOS. And then when I finally did get it to install, it was like the entire OS installing over itself again, like I was going from Catalina to Big Sur. But let's say like 5 hours later, and this is why they released it late, because it was like after work hours. 5 hours later, my Mac had updated. And, you know, and there's a few things. Like one of the first things people went to go hunt down was, what does that crazy battery widget look like, or battery icon? In system preferences and the battery setting look like, because it was just like atrocious before. It reminded me of like Tesla's old UI before it had kind of the iOS 7 era change, like, to it.
2001 clip art from Microsoft Word or something. That's what
it's all the same. Yeah. The new one, it doesn't matter how you feel about the new one, it's just that it's better. And it fits in with the rest of the OS. So I'm glad that the internet kind of affected that change, because
I'd really love to know if like Apple was satisfied with that icon when they shipped the first beta, or if it
was a placeholder, just,
like, a placeholder image. You know what I mean? Because it's so far apart from the one they've changed it to as well. Like,
the
old one was just literally like a green gradient with the percentage written over the middle of it, and now they actually have like someone that's actually been like drawn by an artist. You know what I mean?
The other one like had to be. I don't know, but you're right.
Do you know what I mean?
It was a placeholder. Like,
if it's going to be a placeholder icon, you think they just wouldn't include an icon and just leave it blank or something? But maybe someone really thought that icon was going to be acceptable. But I'm glad they saw the errors in their ways.
Yeah. So I saw like it, for all the people who were on Big Sur Beta 3 before I was, like that's the thing that people went to. I didn't see a whole lot of like the reaction aside from that of like what was a kind of a top level change. But it did seem like, just from kind of the work situation among 9to5 Mac, that not many people were either running the beta or were running the beta on a notebook or had updated the beta. And so I was just like, I just shared, you know, things here and there. And I was like, oh, there's the music icon for Mac OS Big Sur, just like it is on iOS. I took a screenshot, you know, just normally, and I loved the new screenshot sound and macOS Big Sur in beta 1 and 2. Beta 3, I don't know if it's a bug or not, but it's one of the new sounds plus the old sound, and so you can imagine that's not ideal.
Like
having two distinctly different sounds. The new one was like generic computer sound. It was just like a kind of a beep sound, but it was pleasant. The old one is like, you know, you take a picture and you're like, you do the film reel stuff, and it's like that realistic camera sound, which on iOS 14 they never changed it to the new sound, because iOS 14 doesn't get any of the new macOS sounds. iOS 7 was the update that got new sounds for iOS, and then the screenshot sound is always like the camera shutter button sound. In this case, it's like the cool like sci-fi sound plus the film reel, and it's
that's got to be a bug, right?
Yeah, it's got to be a bug, because it's so bad that it can't, like, you'd either revert it if you didn't think it was the right thing to do for a screenshot.
We couldn't choose, so we gave you both of them.
Yeah, because it's just like it's distinctly different sound stacked. My view on that is that the new sound is excellent. The beta 1 and beta 2 sound is excellent compared to the camera sound. I absolutely loathe when I take a screenshot, because I take a lot of screenshots for work, obviously, and you know, somebody's walking by or somebody's in, like, you know, the cafe back when you could go to places, and you do a screenshot and you're like, your volume's way up and you don't even think about it because you're not playing anything, and it sounds like you just snuck a picture, like, you know, because there's no camera visible, like, and I hate it. So to disassociate taking a screenshot with like taking a picture of something in your environment, I am all for that, you know. So I hope they resolve that. Again, battery's better. I noticed on my MacBook Pro that in the first two betas that they were showing you, pretty unreliable, but at least it existed, estimates of like how long your battery life would last until it died and how long until charging. This was obviously a big reversal compared to a few years ago when they, you know, took that feature, that years-long feature that pretty much always existed, away, because they thought it wasn't a an accurate representation.
Yeah, they took it away with the 16-inch MacBook Pro because people were upset that the battery life was shorter.
Right. And their reason was that, you know, that a number of factors can change. You know, what you're doing right now can versus 30 minutes from now, indexing, all the iCloud stuff. So they took it away. It was back in beta 1 and beta 2 of Big Sur. It's gone on beta 3. I think gone is what will ship. And I think it'll be a distinction of Intel versus ARM. That's a total guess. But like my reasoning, but when we talked about it before, was, well, they brought it back because the ARM Macs are going to have really good battery life.
And right.
You know, so they're going to want to compare. But I think the middle ground they might actually take in this case, unless it was just totally a fluke and it just won't come back, is that you don't get your battery life remaining on beyond percentage on Intel because it's not great and it's never going to be great. But we'll show you on an ARM chip.
Yeah, because you can't really compare if one of them is not going to show it, if you see what I mean.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And they'll still sell Intel Macs and for a long time, and then they'll still support Intel Macs for an even longer time.
If you follow the conspiracy theory that Apple just removed it because they were embarrassed by the battery life being short, yeah, then there would be ample reason to bring it back when the battery life gets really good again, i.e., the ARM Macs are out.
that's right.
Yeah.
And then you know, I guess the kind of counter argument against that is that there's not an equivalent of battery life remaining or time until charge on iPhone and iPad, right? And that's, you know, Apple's chip.
Yeah, people just get on with it, right?
Yeah. So maybe it was just a fluke that they had it there, and it was just a part of, you know, changing the menu bar and control center being a thing. So,
and I mean, it is true that it's never been accurate anyway. Like, it depends on what you're doing. It can just, if you browse the web, you're going to have longer battery life. If you suddenly, you know, start rendering a video, it's going to go way down. And so your estimate, if you look in the morning at how long your battery life you've got, it's kind of irrelevant because it can never really know what you're going to do.
So. Yeah. The thing that you do not want to do, and I've experienced it in this beta, is I think in the menu bar, your battery percentage just can't be shown as a percent sign, like the number. It's just the icon. You've got to, you know, interact with it to see the percent, which is the default before, but you could turn on the percentage, and I'm okay with that. Like, I get by. But I would look at it and see, oh, I'm in the red, and it says I've got 30 minutes. So I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing for like 20 minutes and then go plug in, and then the Mac will die between now and then. So you just cannot make your plans based on that. So
yeah. So it being gone kind of makes sense, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. It's no big deal.
And even in our Mac land, I don't think they're going to be able to get more accurate time estimates. So
sure. Yeah. That's fair. It'll just be a bigger number.
It'll just be a bigger number to start with. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I think that's it for macOS Pixar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For the week. Okay. Let's talk about some ARM stuff. So the first thing on to discuss is, you know, this idea that Apple is, you know, for years they've been building their chips on the ARM sort of instruction set, and you know, for iPhone and iPad. Now they're going to do it with Mac starting later this year. So why doesn't Apple just buy ARM and then they even own the instruction set? Like, is there a benefit to that or not? And then that would also affect, I guess, you know, Android phones, all the mobile devices use ARM chips, like so much stuff uses ARM chips. So then Apple they'd benefit from receiving, I guess, licensing fees from that. And fast forward to now is, you know, that's kind of the idea.
Yeah, because SoftBank, who owns ARM at the moment, is trying to actively sell it off. So
yeah. And so
the
now,
idea
yeah,
buying it is cropped up.
Yeah. And the idea was like, you know, It's always been kind of floated as like, you know, if Apple's going to switch, then why don't they just buy up the whole thing? And now that it actually is for sale, it's like, oh, well, what about Apple? You know, and there seems to be this report out this week. This comes from Bloomberg that wasn't impossible. Like, it was actually discussed, but there's no plan to even actively make a bid, much less actually complete the purchase, right?
Yeah. And it seems like NVIDIA is going to make a serious bid. So they might be the ones to eventually own it. And like, I don't think Apple could ever acquire ARM for any benefit to them and get away with it from a like anti-competitive standpoint. Like, I'm pretty sure it would just get rejected by the approval boards, because you can't buy the instruction set and then just shut off all your competition from the, like,
yeah,
everything in the modern world relies on ARM architecture. There's no way a regulator, you know, whether it's Europe or the US or anyone,
right,
would let you know, Apple, the biggest company in the world, essentially, the biggest owner of ARM devices, the biggest seller of ARM devices, just buy up the instruction set and then immediately like cut it off for everyone. You could probably negotiate an arrangement where Apple bought it, but then they still agreed to let other people license it, right? But at that point, what are they buying it for? So it's kind of pointless.
The point there, I guess, would be that if they think there's a business, there's a revenue stream in that business that's worth it. But SoftBank selling it for a reason, because it's not, you know, worth it for them.
Apple's selling the hardware that uses the technology. There's way more margin in that than just licensing to everyone else. Do you know what I mean?
Is there any risk? And I guess with NVIDIA, I guess it depends on like who buys it. But you've got assurance that it wouldn't be Google or Intel or some competitor who would close it, because they wouldn't be able to close it off and get by with it. And you know, the US alone and Europe alone, just there'd be so much trouble with that, it wouldn't be possible. But is there any interest? Is there any risk in somebody incompetent buying it and then it just all goes wrong? What is Apple's reliance on ARM in the instruction set, and how does it change year to year? NVIDIA sounds like a very good candidate for buying it and maintaining it, but could it go to the wrong hands and that negatively affect Apple?
Yeah, that is a good question. Like, I think in the modern day, Apple depends on what ARM's doing, very at arm's length, to use the oh my pun. God, yeah. Like, they have adopted some of their, because with the Apple A4 chip and the Apple A5 chip, like the original ones, they were basically taking the ARM designs off the shelf and just rebranded them with very minor tweaks and shipping them as Apple's chips, right? Because ARM make like reference designs which are called the Cortex processors, and so the A4 and the A5 were basically ARM reference designs that Apple branded as their own while they were like spinning up the silicon division, right? So before they started, you know, seriously designing their own chips, they basically just were acquiring existing designs that ARM had made already and just using them for the iPhone and the iPad. And even Johnny Tsurugi admits this, because if you watch the WWDC keynote, he starts talking about their timeline of custom silicon at the A5X, which was the first year they weren't just like straight cloning the ARM stuff, right? So but design like premises of the ARM chips, I think architecturally, do actually still come into the phone. Like the whole like the big little design where you have some high efficiency cores and some performance, some like low power high efficiency cores and others which are just like raw performance. So the idea is you get better battery life by just depending on like the 4 or 5 efficiency cores when you don't actually need to be doing anything serious, and then when you're doing hard, you know, computation, you can then get the performance out of the performance cores. That like big little architecture originated from ARM, and so when Apple first did that, that was like Apple's interpretation of another ARM reference design. So I think there is a potential damaging effect if someone bought them and ARM stopped innovating their reference designs, but in the modern day, I don't think Apple would let that become a problem. Like, they're already designing silicon at such a low level that they probably don't really need ARM anymore, apart from the licensing stuff, right? And I'm sure, like, these are all private negotiations, but there's no way that Apple's license to ARM can just be terminated if someone else buys them and gets fed up, right? They will have a many-year perpetual license to the architecture and instruction set. Like, I don't know if it's 10 years, 15 years, 5 years. They'll have, like, companies of you know, billion-dollar companies don't have such open weaknesses in their business models where if some company they depend on gets bought out, their whole business is screwed. Like, that's just not going to happen. There will be, you know, maybe it's a license to all current ARM instruction sets forever, and if they make changes, then they have to renegotiate or something along those lines, right? The risk of a bad company buying it and then just giving up on it is just not going to happen at all. Yeah. So, and maybe down, and maybe if you know, NVIDIA bought it, Apple started pondering the idea of, do we really need to use the ARM instruction set? Maybe we can design an instruction set of our own, potentially. Like,
and it's really Apple silicon.
Yeah, make it like even more Apple silicon than already is today. That, again, will be like a multi-year transition process. But what you probably find is that like Apple can design, you know, on the long, you know, time scale, a new instruction set that's like backwards compatible, but also, you know, has what they need. And they already do that to some extent today with custom extensions and stuff. So, like, practically, I don't think there's any risk that you know, that a Chinese company is going to buy ARM and then, you know, not license its technology out to anyone, or, you know, replace that with any company in the world. Like, that's just not going to happen. Is there maybe some more annoyances that might come up if some company buys it and then they stop innovating on the ARM designs and Apple doesn't have, you know, reference designs to fall back on in places where they need it? But, you know, possibly. But I think it's small. Like, Apple is a good company at making silicon, and they're beating the industry. Like, changes to the way ARM works probably affect Apple's competitors more than Apple itself.
Sure. Yeah. Well, there's less customization happening.
Apple just has so much resource. They can work around all sorts of stuff, right? And the core issue that I have seen that, you know, floated about on Twitter is, like, you know, Apple and NVIDIA don't get on very well, as we see in their GPU selections, right? If NVIDIA bought ARM, maybe they'd, you know, turn a hot, cold shoulder to Apple and not let them license the instruction set anymore. I think that's like a fairy tale. Like, the contractual arrangements will not allow that to happen. It's just impossible.
And just for a second, can you characterize the disagreement between Apple and NVIDIA? Because I know that reputation, and it just tends to be that, like, my hunch at it would be that NVIDIA isn't interested in targeting Mac for their GPUs, or it's a business relationship where Apple prefer, like, they get a better deal from AMD. Is that the alternative?
Yeah, currently right now they obviously rely on AMD GPUs. When the Apple Silicon Macs come out, it seems like they're going to go to fully custom in-house GPUs as well.
But is that why they don't?
I think money's part of it. There's also just like a philosophical thing where Apple wanted to retain the right, I believe, to like sign off on the drivers that go into macOS, and NVIDIA balked at that, and they were like, you know, we want to design the drivers how we want them to be designed.
Right.
Yeah. It never, because back in the day, like 2010, 2011, they did use NVIDIA GPUs. And clearly there was a breakdown in communication somewhere where maybe NVIDIA wanted to do something and Apple didn't like it and they blocked it from happening. And then NVIDIA wouldn't change. Then Apple switched to AMD GPUs out of spite because they couldn't come to a deal, right? So
if Apple wasn't doing the Apple silicon
transition, you know, I could have seen a world where they got back on good terms with NVIDIA and did the same thing. Like, because they even support NVIDIA. NVIDIA wanted to support external GPUs, right? Like, for that kind of stuff. And they, you know, they got along a little bit in that domain. But for the pro market, obviously people would prefer NVIDIA GPUs way more than AMD GPUs. And so in the next, like, 5-year time frame, I could probably see a day where Apple and NVIDIA made up and they started offering GPU options again. But now that Apple's doing this silicon transition, it seems like they're going all in on their own GPUs as well as their own CPUs. So that's kind of out the window. They're just going to, you know, blast ahead with their own plans.
Yeah, you don't have NVIDIA GPUs and iPads. Or Apple TVs, which, you know, gaming thing. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about this benchmark stuff. So this is my take on this, and then you kind of correct me where I'm wrong. But I believe that with the developer transition kit for macOS Big Sur running on ARM on Apple Silicon, you can, you know, obviously you can try and use like macOS benchmark tools, but It's none of it is very accurate because it's all sort of it has the downside of being emulated or having to run through Rosetta 2. So it's not a representation of how fast is this Mac running a native app. It's how fast is this app when it's running emulated. The difference in what happened then and now is that a contact of ours was able to you know, and they'll be anonymous for obvious reasons, but they were able to run like actual iOS apps, which is part of like the promise of the ARM of Apple Silicon. You know, that's what's coming. They were able to verify, okay, this is the actual Instagram app. I'm able to like tweak it a little bit, and then now I can actually run it on this Mac, on this Mac Mini DTK. What if I ran an iOS benchmark tool? You know, is that would that then that would be native? And from what we can see now, that's the case. What I don't really understand or get, I guess, is what's the difference in doing this on the GTK versus doing this on an iPad? Is it that the RAM difference makes it, you know, the RAM amount difference makes it a different result or what?
That's a fair question.
Okay.
You would expect that an A12Z running on the Mac natively versus the A12Z running the iPad, it should give similar scores. You'd think that makes sense, right? Like,
yeah. But I see listed in the tool that RAM is one of the things that is at least listed, and I'm not sure if it's just that it's listed or if it's relevant.
The main scores that people care about are just like the single core and multi-core score, and that has very little to do with, you know, RAM availability. We definitely see in these numbers the improvement of running through a Rosetta versus running native, because we spoke about the Rosetta benchmarks on this show, you know, 2 weeks ago or whatever, and they were getting like scores around 800, and now we're seeing scores of like 1100. So it's much more in line. I wish I knew off the top of my head what the iPad Pro actually achieves, but it should be in that range, surely, because it's the same hardware.
Like, right, yeah.
It doesn't.
We can look up in a second.
Yeah. It doesn't... it shouldn't be like out of whack, unless just like the macOS Big Sur isn't fully optimized yet for the chip, right? That'd be the only reason you could have a discrepancy like that. Like,
yeah.
This whole thing of running the iOS apps prematurely is really interesting, because like this is a promise for the ARM Max, but officially you shouldn't be able to do this until the fall, when the Mac App Store starts listing the iOS apps, right?
That's right, yes.
And this hack, I think, involves running through downloading the iPad version of the app and then like porting it to the Mac and then running that, like executing that, essentially.
It's like, all security features off. I think you're in, it's not like you can just, if you have the DTK, you just, you know, download the app and do it. It definitely requires sort of the finessing that people do to, you know, kind of reverse engineer stuff.
Yeah, but it's really cool to see the final results. And
yeah,
I think a lot of people are going
to... We are so excited for these apps to be in the Mac.
Yeah, like, and they're basically going to be similar. They're like, in terms of user experience, they'll be very similar to like, a Catalyst app where the developer has done nothing to customize them, if you see what I mean. Like,
you know, I hadn't really considered it, but I'm not sure what the answer is. I guess it depends, but will it be possible? We know it's possible for a developer to put an app out that runs on the on the iPhone, iPad, and the Mac. And the idea of the iPhone app or the iPad app on the Mac is that it wasn't there before, now it is. But what if the Mac app is just not very good? You know, is there still... You know, I guess it depends on what the developer decides, but could you prefer the iPad version over like the fully supported, you know, still in development Mac version, you know, just because you prefer the same features or same layout and everything? I wonder.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there'll be some apps where like the Mac app is just not considered to be very good, and you just rather have the iPad version.
Yeah,
right? It is up to the developer's discretion whether they want to list the iOS apps on the Mac option. Mm-hmm. So by default, all iOS apps in the store are enabled for that. So there should be, you know, millions upon millions of apps available for our Macs through that method. But the developers can choose to turn it off. So
you could see like how an app isn't updated for the Big Sur design yet, and that in the short term, the iPad app fits in better.
Yeah,
and
it's got so much. It, sure.
Yeah, it's got so much functionality. So.
Or if you have like a developer who quote unquote has a Mac app, but it's not up to date very often.
That's the more popular scenario, I believe.
Yeah, or it's like old and crusty, but they haven't turned off the option, so you can just run the iPad app instead. Yeah, like I'm sure there'll be cases like that. For some of the most popular apps, we have to see whether they, you know, are mean and turn it off, like Instagram, right? Like,
or I'm like sure Netflix.
You'd love to have Instagram, you know, running natively.
I mean, I think that's a, you know, it's been a joke on the for the iPad for so long that you can't have Instagram be a native iPad app. You can do like the web app and you can save it as a clip, and then it's like almost there, but it's not the same. And you know, you can run it as like, you can run the iPhone version zoomed way up, or just like surrounded by a bunch of black space on the iPad, and it's only in portrait orientation, not landscape. You know, and it's kind of funny now that we as it appears, you'll be able to run the iPhone app on the Mac as just like a windowed app. And I think that there's utility in that, you know, if you're managing a social media account on Instagram for a long time, you know, you can do the web, you can do the scaled up app on the iPad. You know, I suppose there's some tools to manage that as well. But if you just want to use the actual Instagram app and just, you know, post one thing per day on an account, you've got to, you know, you can do Twitter on the phone, or Twitter on the Mac, Facebook on the Mac, because it's on the web. You can do all these different things on the Mac. But then for Instagram, I think you've got to go to your phone to do that. So having that as an app on the Mac, like there's utility in that. So I think there's a lot of scenarios where I'm just thrilled about this change and being able to have that flexibility. We did see with Netflix was like, we're not going to do a Catalyst app. And that was without knowing that our Mac, that iPhone apps were coming to the Mac just by nature
by
of it
default,
being,
yeah,
by default, because it's an Apple Silicon Mac, you know, it's a hardware change, but still, surely they won't opt out of surely they won't like turn off their iPad app from being a Mac app.
I wouldn't bet against it.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I think there's like legal things about that where
screen sizes and is that about it?
Yeah, because like Microsoft Office has this thing where if you're running on an iPad smaller than 10 inches, you can use it for free. But if it's bigger than 10 inches, then you have to pay for it. And maybe Netflix has an issue where they, you know, their legal rights with people say you can't run it in this Mac client, or you have to get approval because the, you know, some random arcane rule about piracy, for instance. Like, there's a lot of just big company mess that it's probably easier for them just to turn it off than to leave it on, if that makes sense. Even just like the support burden of like, you know, we want you to use Netflix through the website. We don't want you to use Netflix, the Mac app, right? That isn't really the Mac app. Like, that unfortunately, I wouldn't be surprised if Netflix is one of the people that do actually turn it off.
Yeah. Yeah. All of this just talk, I mean, regardless of what Netflix does, all of this, you know, I talk about the iPhone and iPad apps on the Mac. If you have an iMac, just completely sells me on wanting an iMac so bad as soon as they're available. I've been a little bit hesitant. It's like, I need to have a decision kind of, you know, path where it can't be, oh, now it's available, I buy it. You know, and it replaces like the 16-inch MacBook Pro that had different features. It needs to be, you know, I've got to have a path of, well, it's got to have this, got to have that, or else I don't do it because I don't need a MacBook Air, for example. But, you know, that's something I got to think about, is like, what are the things that prevent me, would make me wait for something later in the lineup to come about?
Or yeah, because like the first last week, just okay? You spoke about Quo.
Mm-hmm.
Saying that the 16-inch MacBook Pro with ARM silicon won't be coming until middle of next year, so it doesn't seem like it's going to be the first bunch. So you're going to have some patience if you want the direct replacement for the 16-inch.
Yeah. All right. I am in a situation where I've hot cornered into a screen off mode. So so bear with me while I enter my password, but I assume everything's functioning the same.
That's quite funny.
And the
hot corner, the hot corner has messed you up.
Yeah, it has. I mean, it might be time to turn that off now. And of course, my password is wrong because I'm putting in the wrong password. And that's fun.
You're under pressure.
Yeah, I'm glad nothing broke though. We're all still here, so that's good. It's a really good test of what happens when your display goes to sleep during a broadcast. Let's talk about some iPhone 12 stuff. So this is a really, really cool story to me. It's kind of I guess it's exactly the way that we figured out. You know, what would the XS Max look like?
Mm-hmm.
This is a story about, you know, what will the smaller than iPhone 11 Pro look like? Because the rumor this year is that the Pro, not Max, gets smaller and the Max gets bigger, right? And so now we've kind of got a clue of what does that look like in terms of how iOS looks, right?
For sure, yeah. Like the iPhone 10. iPhone 11 Pro, iPhone XS, like non-Max, those devices have never offered a feature called Display Zoom, which is where you can basically access, you can have the normal screen resolution, or you can scale up a smaller resolution, which basically makes all the content bigger. It's offered on the Plus phones, because basically the Plus phones emulate the resolution of the non-Plus version. Similarly with the Max, it emulates the 11 Pro. So the 11 Pro Max, if you use Display Zoom in Zoom mode, it's the screen resolution 11 Pro, but the iPhone 10, iPhone XS, iPhone 11 Pro have never had like a smaller sibling to emulate in terms of the resolution, so they've just never offered the option. But it turns out in this latest beta of iOS 14, you can actually enable Display Zoom at that zoom scale, and it's using a new resolution that we haven't seen before on an iPhone.
Sure.
It's a 960 by 2079 across, and so it seems pretty likely that is the resolution of this upcoming form factor 5.4 inch phone. And so if you have an iPhone 11 Pro right now, like I do, you can turn on Display Zoom and you can see what we think the screen, it won't obviously be zoomed up in terms of physical size, but in terms of the amount of content you can see on screen at the same time, we think we know what the 5.4 inch phone will look like.
Okay. And then what we did here is, if you're listening, you can't see it, but you can go to the site and see it. But it's like a real comparison to scale of, this is the iPhone 11 Pro. This is that phone. This is how much smaller, like physically, which we know from, which we believe from reporting, from the rumors, with like Quo, for example, and then match that with this resolution. And like, this is what you'll get. Right.
So yeah, and you can,
it's a really big clue
how the UI adapts. Like, in most places it's fine because obviously it's still bigger than like the 4-inch phones in terms of resolution. So, because I put on the zoom mode and just checked around the operating system to see if any like weird truncation and stuff.
Sure.
It mostly seems fine. Like in the mail app, when you press reply and it comes up, there's like 20 options and the top option has like four things in a row, like straight across. That gets redesigned, so it's 2 and 2. But there's no truncation or like awkwardness.
I mean, because
for the most part, they've adapted quite well.
This becomes the new default. I mean, we talked about it for years in this podcast. Where like the SE never got iOS designed for it because by that point they moved on to larger phones.
Yeah.
And so there's truncation galore. The Plus and Max phones have never been like the most popular phones. So you don't get iOS taking full advantage of that design wise. And so what was the, at first it was the iPhone 6 size, and and then when the iPhone 10, that became like the default. It changed a little bit whenever you have the 10R and 11 non-pro, because it's the same resolution as the Max phone, just not the same screen size. So then
it's not the same resolution. It's the same, it's dimensions. The same like logical point size, but it's 3x versus 2x, right?
Sure, so sure. Yeah.
The layout of everything on the screen's the same, but it's not the same resolution.
Yeah, not as sharp, but it's the right. same. It's the same layout wise, yeah. Which is like kind of what you're designing around. And so, in this case, maybe that means that because 11 is the kind of the mainstream phone, that's where iOS design becomes default for, and that this say 12 Pro that's smaller than the 11 Pro, it's not the most affordable phone. It's higher end. I wonder if this, how iOS design will be affected, because it does take the target from iPhone 6 screen size to iPhone 10 screen size to now it's smaller than the default. And do you have to deal with that truncation like you would on an SE phone?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think in general the issues of like screen size optimization get less as screens get bigger. Right.
Sure. So there's a threshold that we've hit where it may not be a problem anyway.
Yeah. Like the SE was problematic because it's just small, right? And it was just
narrow. Yeah.
And Apple was designing for like 4.7 inch phones predominantly. And so the SE would just have truncation left, right, and center. When they were focusing on 4.7 inch, it felt like the Plus phone, the 5.5 inch phone, was not having its screen used to the full effect, right? Because it felt just everything was really stretched out where they could have more UI or more features. And we've kind of seen that carry on with the Max phones too. They've addressed that a bit this year with stuff like picture in picture. That's definitely a great feature to add on to the biggest phones. But in terms of just like layout problems or things looking bad, I don't think as long as you're bigger than like the Plus phones in terms of resolution, which is what this one still is, even if it be very slightly smaller in physical size, you're not going to have like layout issues of stuff just not being able to fit, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's really interesting to see what the OS will look like on this phone that's not out yet. And because it's such a different resolution, it means that all the third-party apps are letterboxed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So until the apps update this fall, when Apple announces the new size, all the third-party apps won't be full screen on the 5.4-inch phone. They have a top and bottom letterboxing.
Yeah, I see that now with Instagram. That's the first one to go to. So it's like running Instagram on an iPad. It's a little bit. Not that dramatic, but a little bit.
Yeah, and obviously all the third-party apps can't address that size yet, so it's not their fault. But
right, exactly, yeah. This is a really good way to test it. So if you're running the iOS 14 Beta 3 or Public Beta 2, then you can, and you have an iPhone, what is it, 10, 10S, or 11 Pro, then you'd be able to go into the settings and display and turn on the zoom mode. And then, of course, it's a bigger tap target than you actually get, but it's the same amount of UI that you'll get in terms of, where you can touch things and how things are laid out. So this is a good test run for me because, you can decide, is this too much? Is this not enough? Too much isn't going to be a problem. Is this not enough compared to what I'm used to?
Yeah, I like the current iPhone 11 Pro size, not the Max, the normal one. But I used the display zoom for a good 15 minutes, and I didn't feel like it was... I feel like I could live with it if I wanted to. Do you know what I mean? It didn't feel constrained.
And accessibility-wise, it's good to have this as an option, because before, and you mentioned at the top of this discussion, display zoom has always been a feature that worked because you were using a larger phone and you could go back to the smaller phone's interface on the larger screen. And so it just happened to work that way. And in this case, you know, with iOS 14, it doesn't matter if you ever needed that smaller phone or any of that. You know, basically what I'm saying is they could never release a smaller iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a feature that you can use right now.
Yeah, and it has value. Like,
exactly right.
If you're someone who has bad eyesight, the default go-to solution would be to change the text size, right? Mm-hmm. But that only helps so much, because for a start, if you make text size really big, the controls don't change around it, so it just looks stupid, right? Whereas if you're changing display zoom settings, the whole UI is changing in proportion to each other, so you still get the same layouts of each item basically on the screen, but they're all slightly bigger. This is especially true for the keyboard, right? Like if you change the text size on the keyboard doesn't do anything, it just stays the same. But if you're display zooming, the keyboard's getting physically bigger, so easier tap targets, especially if you're older, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. Display zoom is a good feature. Like my grandpa uses a iPhone 8 now, the standard 4.7 inch phone, and he is, you know, he's not just his eyesight, it's also just that he's, you know, big fingers and he's not used to touchscreens. So we use display zoom on that, and it's way better experience than if it was the native resolution. Then yeah, because it's just stuff slightly bigger. It's and it doesn't put things out of whack like what happens when you make text size really big.
You know, it'd be really clever as if Apple just in an update said, we now, you know, starting this fall on iOS 14, will support display zoom on iPhone 11 Pro, iPhone XS, iPhone X, because it's been here on the Max phones, it's been here on the 11, for example, but you know, you don't have it on that line.
Yeah.
And they just said, update your apps for it, you know, and then some of the apps would just be ready when the new thing comes out, you know, regardless of the announcement and release period.
Yeah, they should have done that WWDC. Like, if they were going to add it in beta 3, people are going to make the link that is probably the resolution for the new phone anyway. So they should have done that in June and just said, look, we're adding a display zoom option. This is the resolution. Make sure your app support it for the full.
Yeah, because I really do not think this is bad looking at all. On other phones, I guess the fact that the phones are just bigger, it makes it look a little bit more comical if you're used to the tighter UI.
Yeah.
When you get away from actual accessibility reasons. But in this case, it doesn't look comical. It just looks like it's just edge-to-edge content.
You know what it reminds me of, kind of? It's like the iPad home screen options where you have like the denser one, or you have the stuff where the icons are really big.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, you could even crank your text size back down from the default, and then you just have bigger touch targets, and you know, it's totally usable. It's kind of like changing your MacBook Pro resolution from the default back down to like the actual resolution of your display, right? It looks bigger, but it's sharper.
Yeah, in this case, it's not sharper because
no, it's not sharper, but
it's the same idea of taking a different like logical resolution, just stretching it to fit. Because so like on the MacBook Pro, if you'd go to those smaller sizes where stuff gets bigger, that's exactly what display zoom is.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Let's see if I can get us out of here. iPhone 12 stuff. So this is a story this week on what the battery capacity could be. So what's that all about?
Yeah, it seems like the capacity is getting smaller. So at least one iPhone 12 model will apparently feature a 2,775 milliamp hour battery, which would be the lowest in a while, because like the 11 Pro's above 3,000, the iPhone 11 non-Pro's above 3,000. The XS was 2658, so it's going back down to that range. Seems like a regression, but again, it depends. You know, it all comes down to the efficiency of all the other components, right? Like, battery life is not solely dictated by battery capacity. if you have an if the A14 chip is more efficient, they can get away with having a smaller battery and still having the same result. So it's an interesting that they've gone, because it's quite, it's not just like slightly down, it's like 10%.
It will make like YouTubers mad.
Yeah, obviously people get upset about it, but in terms of real world impact, we'll just have to wait and see in the fall, because especially in the light of the fact that these phones are going to have all 5G stuff, 5G radios through them, that tend to use up a lot of battery. So the fact that battery is getting smaller is kind of weird, but you know, I don't want to make a mountain out of a molehill on this one too soon.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
And then we talked last week about the braided lightning cable coming with that, you know, leaked out of nowhere. It's like, okay, now we seem to have seen it.
Yeah, so in this picture that you can find on the Knife Mac website, the black cable is the one that currently ships with the 2019 Mac Pro.
That's where they did braided before. Yeah.
Before, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So
is different than the HomePod cable in that it's a removable cable that works with things besides the power outlet in your house.
Yeah. So the 2019 Mac Pro comes with a braided Lightning to USB-C cable, and so in this photo you can see that cable next to the new one, which will be the one that's supposedly shipping with the iPhone 12, and it looks, you know, just like the old Lightning to USB-C cable, except it's now braided, which should improve durability. It's not clear if they're going to ship this cable with every model, because obviously right now only the 11 Pro and 11 Pro Max get the USB-C cable, whereas the base level 11 still has the USB-A cable. If they do ship USB-C on everything, you're going to have more of that problem of like people just generally don't have USB-C chargers in abundance, whereas they do have, you know, old style rectangular USB ports around the place. So it would be kind of odd if they do that, but
they'd love to dream retract this. Tweet's gone at least.
Oh, did he delete it?
They deleted it. Yeah.
Oh,
I notice it's not there in the. Well, it's not live in the story.
Well, maybe it's not the cable.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, okay, so there's a live update on that story, but you know, backtrack from that, and you do have the idea from last week that there would be this braided cable in there. This just might not be the one that we're looking at. It might not be the one that we're
just
looking at.
Just imagine a slightly different braided cable.
Yeah. We're all for braided cables, though. Bring them on. I know we're running long a little bit this week. I want to spend a few minutes reading our Q&A on YouTube, which if you haven't before, you can always watch the podcast with video on YouTube. And we usually air live at 4 p.m. Eastern time on Thursdays, unless I'm traveling, which next week I'll be traveling, you know. But let's look at some questions here. Early on, someone asked if there's any signs of touch ID under display. I'd say the answer to that is like, it's like non-zero, right? But it's not in the cards for this year.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, there's still a lot of rumors about it coming back at some point, but
I want it worse than ever, you know, both because of the mask thing, you know, with wearing a face covering, as we do everything we can to stop the spread of COVID-19. But also, you know, now that I'm riding the motorcycle primarily, I'm wearing a motorcycle helmet, and that will never work, you know, because it's like everything but my eyes in the helmet that I wear. And so many occasions now where, and that was always the case for a lot of people, like that there's a huge market of people that their jobs require them to cover their faces, or their culture requires them to cover their faces. And so Face ID becomes a non-option. Touch ID, the same situation where you can be washing dishes, you wear gloves for work, whatever. You wear motorcycle gloves. So in that case, you know, no fingers, no face, fingertips. And so having both would be cool. It's always been the case. It's just a matter of pulling it off technologically, right?
Yeah, like I think Apple's probably waiting until they can do like under the screen fingerprint recognition on a wide area of the screen, because a lot of Android phones have underscreen fingerprint now, but it's still kind of limited to like this exact circle at the bottom or just the very bottom of the phone. Like, ideally, you don't want to have that complexity, and it's just like, just put your finger on the phone in the middle or wherever you want, and we'll, you know, we can detect it and unlock it. So I think that's probably what Apple's working towards. And then, yeah, they'll eventually offer a phone that has both Face ID and Touch ID, because you're never going to be able to get a perfect Face ID system. You're never going to get a perfect Touch ID system either. But if you can blend the two together and just say, like, let the user in as long as one of these methods are authenticated by, you're just going to have a nicer user experience overall. And
yeah,
it just doesn't seem like it's on the cards for this year, but maybe next year's phone, potentially.
Yeah, one thing I will say is, you know, they do trust you on your Mac, or trust the system on your Mac, that if you unlock with your passcode once, or you know, put in your Mac password and you wear an Apple Watch that's also unlocked, in terms of your passcode, you know, has been put in, then the watch unlocks the Mac, and that doesn't apply to the phone or the iPad, which is in so many ways like the Mac. So it seems like that's something that ought to be considered. I don't see.
Yeah, like they kind of have the chain of command because the fact that like the iPhone unlocks the Apple Watch, right?
Can doesn't have to.
Yeah, like they kind of maybe can reconsider that. So if you don't have that option on, you can go the other way around. That'd be useful. But
yeah,
there was you know, this technical that's like hard security stuff that I'm sure they've thought about. So
And then same realm, reverse charging in the iPhone 12. That was so heavily rumored and expected for the iPhone 11 series. It just didn't happen, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think German said they just failed to get the software working, to have it working great, like, and so it got pulled out.
Yeah, which Samsung has. I haven't seen, like, negative reviews of how it works for Samsung.
I honestly think people just don't really use it that often.
Yeah, like, that's probably it.
Like, it's there, but how often are you really, like, out and about, you're like, guys, I'm not going to use my phone, but if you want to charge something on top of it, you know, lay it out in this precarious fashion. Like,
yeah, is it cool?
It's a nice little feature. Like, I'm not like going to say it's pointless. And if Apple was working so hard to get it done last year, I wouldn't rule it out happening again.
Sure.
But, you know, it's not like something I'm super invested in seeing.
And to answer the question, the rumor really hasn't returned in the same steam that it was last year, like at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anything to jump out to you, Mayo?
Somebody asked, can you use the iPhone apps on Intel Macs using Big Sur? No, you can't, because you're literally running the compiled code directly, and the compiled code's only built for ARM64, so the Intel version is just incompatible. That's why Apple has Catalyst, right? Otherwise, if you could just run the iPhone apps directly, they wouldn't have bothered with Catalyst in the first place. Rainbow Ram also asked that in Beta 3, you still can't see default app options. We actually have a story on this, so you can actually go on to 9fm.com and we have a here's what the default app UI looks like post where we kind of hacked it together to see it. It basically, in settings for the Safari or an email app, so either an alternative web browser or an alternative email app, when you go into like the settings pane for it, it will have a default browser, default email app option. You click on that, you can choose between a list of everything that's installed, and off you go. We are waiting for Apple to actually release like full policy instructions for who can actually apply and be part of that. Because right now, a developer can't opt into the system. Like, you're probably going to need an entitlement, and Apple hasn't released like the exact rules on who will be able to be applicable or not. So we're still waiting on that side of the equation to settle out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a question for you, do you know when the UK will get new maps?
I mean, they said sometime this year, right? So
yeah.
It's now very firmly in the second half of the year, so soon, I guess.
Yeah. And then I don't see it at the moment, but I saw someone ask, when will the iPhone, or when will the fall event be? You assume September, the first, second week of September, and then this year, WWDC was later for obvious reasons. The fall of it, just an Apple press event is different than an Apple developer conference. So you could see that they, you know, with this much preparation that they would know when to have the event and how to do it, whether it's totally virtual again, or if there is a press involved. I think at the current rate, based on just what's happening in California alone,
it's going to be virtual.
This would be entirely virtual. Yeah. Yep. If it was like anywhere else in the world, it'd be different. But California is having a really hard time right now with the virus. And so I would say totally virtual. And then when is the event? In this case, I think WWDC changed mostly because they had to produce the alternative event, you know, which was so well produced. It wasn't just because it wasn't like a factor. I don't think it was a factor of like iOS wasn't ready enough, because they'll put out some, you know, shaky betas, and then they'll fix them. And this year it was like, oh, these are like beta 2 almost. Well, because we were a couple of weeks later. So I think it was just about production. In terms of this, they have enough foresight, you know, knowing what's happening in the world, that they can produce this thing ahead of time. When to announce it and hold the event, you know, however it's conducted, depends on, I guess, how soon the first piece of hardware in it is. Because they can have one phone, two phones be October or November and announce them in September, as long as they don't have, it'd just be very odd to see a September event first or second week to hold the pattern, but then say, and the first phone will come out in November or October. Right, yeah. You know, you want to do it within like 3 weeks of the first product, you know, being available to purchase is kind of the idea.
Yeah.
This year it won't just be iPhone either. We at least, you know, obviously something with a watch, but also probably the ARM Mac thing. And like, this wouldn't be the year to do multiple events. I don't think, just do it in one tight event.
Yeah. Like, they have a lot of stuff to get through. So they're probably going to have some product ready for September. Like,
sure.
Right. Yeah. And then say like the first of the, two models of the iPhone in like mid October, then a late September event, you know, dovetails in perfectly with that, and then the other two phones are maybe, you know, late October to November. Well, there you go, because that kind of just seems to be what the rumors are pointing to at the moment. Like, maybe one model is delayed in November, but generally they're probably going to at least be ready in October. So, and normally the iPhone event's what, like September 10th, like that first, you know, the first third. Maybe it's now like the last week of September instead, something like that. I think can probably work out, because you'll have. Supposedly, we're going to have the iMac updates, but if they don't do that sooner than that, you've got like the HomePod Mini stuff still in the wings. You've got the watch. You've got the 13-inch MacBook Pro with Apple Silicon. You've got quite a lot in the offing. So, I mean, they might even have bundle stuff as services, subscriptions. So, September event, I probably would bet on that still. And yeah, it's going to be all virtual for sure. Like, it's just unfeasible. Yeah.
I can't wait to virtually attend. All right, that is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. If you enjoy the podcast, please give us a rating and review in Apple Podcast or Overcast or on Spotify. We really appreciate that. It helps more people discover the show, and it helps us keep going. If you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com, and both Benjamin and I will see what you sent us, and we'll hopefully reply to it and go from there. And also, I mentioned I'll be traveling next week. So next week, I'll talk more about what that was for. So that's all from it this week. Anything from you, Mayo?
I'm good. BZA Mayo. Right.
Cool. Yeah, that's where you are on Twitter. You blog at bzmayo.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at ApolloZack, same for Instagram. And check out, this is what I'll promote this week. If you haven't already, search in your podcast app, wherever you listen to this one, for Space Time by Space Explored. And that is my new podcast. About all the space stuff that I've been covering, and there'll be it's weekly, just like this is. You know, the goal is 30 minutes, so it won't be too much to add to your stuff. But if you come to this podcast because you enjoy us, please check it out. I really appreciate that. All right, that is the show for the week. See everybody next week. Bye.